cinema studies, which sort of grew up in the middle 20th century, kind of looked back at early cinema as primitive and rather crude because they weren't able to tell a story in any great detail. They weren't able to cover very much of an event. But in fact, this is not really true. They were just what they were at the time, given the technology that they had.
Out of the silver shadows and into the Klieg lights of movie land comes Nitrateville Radio. This is Michael Gebert in Chicago with Nitrateville Radio, the podcast that talks to people doing cool stuff in the world of vintage film. Brought to you by Nitrateville.com, the discussion site for movies from the vintage era all around the world. The proprietor of this podcast assures the public that no expense has been spared to bring you the finest guests to educate and enlighten you about cinema in the age of Her Majesty Queen Victoria. Including Bryony Dixon of the BFI on the state of cinema in Victoria's time. Maggie Hennefeld on the health risks of allowing women to partake of comedy. And Sam Dunn of Powerhouse Indicator on the celebrated thespian Todd Slaughter. You are cordially urged to subscribe at the podcast application of your choosing. And if you are pleased with what you hear, to entertain the notion of leaving a rating and a review at Apple Podcasts. Your patronage is greatly appreciated. Part the First, Victorian Film. The first exhibition of movies in Britain was in early 1896. Queen Victoria died in 1901. We apply the term Victorian to many things, but those 6 years make up a genuine Victorian era of film, and the British Film Institute has tried to put every British film that exists from that period online. Bryony Dixon, curator of silent film at the BFI National Archive, looks at what these films tell us as examples of a new medium and as pictures of their time in her BFI book, The Story of Victorian Film. I spoke with her from Berkhamsted, Hertfordshire.
So are you a fan of the early film, or are you more of a feature film fan?
I mean, everything. I've been going to Portnoy the last few years. I saw you in the distance at some point in the events there. And, you know, it's made me more receptive to, like, teens, films of the teens and even the aughts. I feel like if you need to have a certain immersion in it, it's not like you can watch one film every 3 years and have a grasp of the period or anything like that, you know. So Portnoy, I'm always getting an immersion in newsreels of royalty from 1906 or, you know, whatever. Well, I get the impression from, like, the intro to the book and things like that, that this really comes out of the fact that the BFI has put a lot of effort into getting as much as they can of films of this period that survive to, you know, up online so that people can kind of see Victorian film in its totality.
That's exactly right, yeah. It all came out of a funding bid, one of those big government funding bids, where we got enough money to do a sort of significant size of project. So we did something like 10,000 films. You know, it was a massive project. So we thought, well, why not do the whole of something? And we thought we would start at the beginning and do digitizations of all of the Victorian era films. So that's anything made between 1895 and the end of 1901. So it's something like 500-ish titles, something like that. And it includes a proportion of the Michelin Kenyan titles that some listeners might be familiar with, which was a collection of films as a sort of great discovery back in the end of the 90s, where these films were all discovered up in the north of England, the kind of original negatives, which were sitting in the back of a photographer's shop, which was a wonderful thing. So 200 of the titles come from that, and the rest are materials really that have survived and been collected since the BFI began in the 1930s. So we were keen really to cover all of the films from that period. And it does a couple of interesting jobs. It does, you know, bring to audiences all the very first films, so you can tell what was going on right at the beginning of cinema, because people are always interested in firsts. And it also enables you to track the changes in that first sort of 5-6 year period, which were considerable. So if you think, for example, of WKL Dixon or the Lumiere brothers and many other companies making one of the first films of a really big international event, which was Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, which was in 1897, that was, you know, it was a thing they chose to go and film. In fact, every film company apart from Edison was there on that day. But by the time Victoria dies in 1901, it's unimaginable that the film cameras wouldn't be recording that event. So a change has happened, and people have begun to go and see films as much more as a matter of course than they did at the beginning when it was just another novelty.
You mention in the book a concept that's come up before on this podcast, which is early film being the cinema of attractions. I think it was Tom Gunning's phrase. And yeah, I kind of know what that means. I mean, obviously, a lot of these things are sort of novelties. But yeah, maybe tell us more what cinema of attractions means.
Yeah, the cinema of attractions, everybody uses the word useful about this concept, and it is incredibly useful. The reason being is that these very, very early films are short, and the reason they're short is that film came in short strips at that time, and people, you know, basically pointed the camera at whatever was in front of it and took a short reel of film. Eventually they became longer, but in that early period, they're very short. Now, there are only certain things you can do with a very short film, and that is to show something moving. You need to have some kind of immediate impact and show something that is going to interest people. So because film comes out of the entertainment world, or its first home is in the entertainment world, i.e. the theatres and music halls and fairgrounds, a lot of what they show is either just street scenes and actualities and things happening that are of natural interest through things like newspapers that you'd expect, or they are things from the world of entertainment, so they're people doing performances in front of the camera. Now, cinema studies, which sort of grew up in the middle 20th century, kind of looked back at early cinema from a perspective of the cinema or the television industries. So they were sort of thinking in terms of films having story or message or something like that, and they were much longer and had time to develop those things. So they look back on early films as primitive and rather crude, because they weren't able to tell a story in any great detail. They weren't able to cover very much of an event, and so on. So they thought that they were primitive and simple, but in fact, this is not really true. They were just what they were at the time, given the technology that they had. And I think they did some really remarkable things with them, given that they were working under those constraints. And certainly by 1901, there are some films of much greater complexity. You're beginning to get continuity editing, for example, and you're beginning to get films strung together in series, so you have much longer films, and they are beginning to cover pretty much all of the events that happen in the world. So they're beginning to get quite sophisticated quite quickly, and they tried absolutely everything you could imagine. So they tried sound. In fact, in our collection, we have a synchronized sound film from 1900, which is a musical performance with the synchronized track, which was recorded on a gramophone, and you can see that and hear it in sync. They tried, of course, color, which was always going to be the next big thing, but they, you know, it proved incredibly difficult to do, as we know. Didn't really come into its own until the middle of the 20th century. So they tried everything that you can imagine in moving images, they tried in those first 5-6 years.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting you're talking about them going out and filming basically what we'd call newsreel footage of real events. But, you know, make the point that it's not really journalism yet, because it can't really tell a story. What it's doing is presenting the spectacle of seeing soldiers on parade or something else like that, or, you know, so like we saw at Portnoy, so many of the ones of personalities, you know, here's King Boris of Bulgaria. Wow, I'm so excited. I've never seen him before, you know, so.
Yeah, probably exciting to some people at the time. But yeah, you do get an awful lot of military parades. And if you're in the business of early film, you've just got to learn to love them. find something to look at in them, because there's a lot of them. And in fact, I did some calculations about how many, I mean, nearly all early film is nonfiction. So it's very unlike today, where fiction kind of dominates. But also there was a spectacular number of military films, huge, huge numbers. But this business about newsreel and journalism, it's very true that they didn't have what we would think of as journalism, the kind of investigative journalism. But they definitely did try, when films got a bit longer, they did try to put together shots in a slightly different way. And they did try and get a sort of sense of story or narrative arc. They're just beginning to do that, really. But a lot of it was straightforward record, and really begins with that Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee, where they're recording really very long lengths of film and then dividing them up into individual shots, which were taken of particular parts of the procession around London, and events that surrounded it that were taken at a different time. So they definitely tried to make up a kind of show. And then when W.K.L. Dixon, who is one of the great unsung heroes of this early period, when he takes his cameras to war down in South Africa, again, he tries to create a sense of story and a sense of continuity. So he takes, for example, several films of particular events. So around the Battle of Spion Kop, which was a terrible, terrible defeat for the British Army. And there are several films that cover events on either side of that big event.
And that's the Boer War?
That's the Boer War, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. So they are trying, and they're also, by 1901 in particular, they're trying to get different types of shots. So, for example, there's a very good Mitchell and Kenyon film which is essentially a group of outtakes of the film from which they would have made up a kind of sequence where they're doing overhead shots, they're doing shots from the ground, so like, you know, in the crowd. They've got great panning shots of the event and the crowds and all kinds of different types of shots, which is sort of like a kit of parts for a later kind of documentary type film.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thing. It's like there, you know, there are a lot of things that people simply didn't see in their everyday lives. You might hear that they existed, but, you know, I mean, seeing the Queen wasn't something in your everyday life, most likely. And, you know, there are other things. I mean, like a lot of fire brigades, much like the marching, you know, the soldiers on parade, you know, the coordination of a group of firefighters is kind of impressive. So that was something that people seemed to like. And then, you know,
again, yes, that's the impact and natural drama of the fire brigade turning out. And again, you know, the early filmmakers copy each other. It's a real feature of Victorian film that everybody copies each other. And it's not exactly that they're plagiarizing. It's just that the stuff that they're hearing about what audiences are responding to, they say, oh, did you see the film showdown at the music hall last week? You know, there was a fantastic film of some sea waves and there was a fantastic thing of the fire brigade turning out. So the filmmakers think that's what audiences want. I must go out and make a film about the fire brigade turnout.
It kind of got me thinking, I mean, can you discern personalities or individual interests in the early filmmakers, or are they all just trying to, you know, give the market what it wants so much that they end up having very similar portfolios of films?
That certainly happens, and it's a very commercial world. But where they copy, they also very soon after begin to differentiate.
Okay.
So in a commercial world, that's what you need. It's driven by novelty and you know, one-upmanship. So that if you are going to do a Fire Brigade film, because the Lumiere brothers have done a Fire Brigade film, or Edison has done one, what you want to do is a Fire Brigade film and then top it. Yeah, so you make it a better Fire Brigade film.
Sure.
So this is how these things develop. And actually, this particular little subgenre is a really good case in point. Because you get a lot of different filmmakers. They start out just showing the horses and the carriage and the firemen coming out, emerging, as it were, from the fire station at full tilt. And then they begin to get a little more complicated. So they'll then show a shot of them arriving, you know, at a house. They'll show them demonstrating different techniques of saving people from a burning building. That kind of thing. So they begin to differentiate and they begin to develop a narrative arc. So by the end of the Victorian era, you got something like James Williamson's Fire, which is a most fabulous and interesting film with the fire, a policeman noticing a fire, a house is on fire, and he runs out of the picture, and there's a cut, and you see him running into the picture, and it's the first ever continuity edit where somebody runs out of frame and into frame, indicating a passage of time.
Right.
Which is wonderful. And he then shows lots of different scenes of people being rescued in a very dramatic fashion and the fire brigade sort of going to the fire. And then this is copied and copied. Life of an American Fireman, of course, I'm sure you know.
Sure.
So that is how the drama develops.
Well, let's talk about some of the other, I mean, I guess the only word I can use is genres, although they're not the genres that we would have later, which are narrative film genres. But some of the other things that you talk about are very common, like travel films, you call them phantom rides, where the camera is on a train and then people, you know, are watching the film as if they're on the train. You know, you talk about trick films, even people getting into, you call plays without words, drama and adaptation. People are starting to do, I don't know, minute-long versions of Hamlet or whatever.
Well, yeah, so all these categories, all these wonderful categories that sort of develop. So as soon as the catalogue develops, so you've got the initial phase where people are just going, oh, wow, look at, you know, here's a photograph that moves. So when you've got the Lumiere brothers doing their show in December 1895, in February you've got Robert Paul and the Lumieres, you know, in London and all over the world. Shortly thereafter, it's all about the machine, you know, it's about the cinematograph or the animatograph. But very shortly thereafter, people suddenly realize it's not about the machine and the show, it's about the films. So they begin to make many, many more films, and they're selling the films directly to other exhibitors. So they have to have a catalogue. And it's in the catalogue where they start to separate them out into these types of films. So they're not really genres, they're sort of categories or types of films. And in the first instance, they really play with what it is that films can do that other media can't do. So The Phantom Ride is a fabulous example. If you want to take a view of something, you sit on something that moves. On a train, on a boat, on a tram, on a roller coaster, exciting stuff. So this gives people a kind of sense of vicarious travel. And it's still quite pleasurable. People love to watch them even now. And again, there are sort of other things that sort of do things that really only film can do. So trick films is a good example, where you can make people vanish by stop motion. You know, a thing that was very difficult to do, that you'd have to mask with a cloud of smoke if you were trying to do it on stage. You can do all sorts of wonderful things, and reversing films and upside down films and all the wonderful things that film can do. So, and then these go in sort of phases and fashions. So people will do reversing films and everybody will go and go, wow, that's fantastic. And then they get bored of it quite quickly. And then you have to think of something else. So there's a lot of different types of fashions that, that come in during that Victorian era and then are lost again. So, you know, Phantom Rides, of course, just becomes another type of film shot rather than a little genre of its own.
Still a sensation. I mean, you think about, like, this is Cinerama. I mean, what's the first thing we get in Cinerama? It's riding a roller coaster.
That's right. So these things are all absorbed into the film grammar as films get longer and more complex. But when they first arrive, of course, are these great novelties.
Yeah. Now, another one I thought was really interesting, and, it, you know, it's, I think, part of why the Mitchell and Kenyon films were considered so charming when they were rediscovered, is the emphasis on local film. Basically, the business model was, you know, you film people in a town and then tell them, you know, they have to come see it tonight at the movie theater. They'll see themselves and their neighbors. And that was the novelty, was, you know, seeing yourself turned into a movie then.
Exactly. And these were immensely fashionable. And again, for a very short period of time. So the local film starts, we have, you know, I really only just discovered this through the Mitchell and Kenyon collection, because not that many of them survive in the world. But they were, you would go to somewhere with a lot of people, film loads of people, hand out a flyer and say, come and see yourself on screen, see yourself as others see you. And if you think of all those sort of, you know, working class people who don't have, you know, mirrors, and stuff like that in their houses. This was quite a thing. And it was a great novelty. And by about 1901, it's gone again. So it's a short-lived genre. It was very, very fashionable. It's noticeable that you get advertisements in the music hall press, which say from, you know, Robert Paul or George Albert Smith or Cecil Hepworth, they all start offering to make local films for exhibitors. So they've seen, you know, the bandwagon. They're trying to jump on this bandwagon. But the moment passes very quickly. And, you know, anyone left with a large number of these things could actually go out of business. So it happened to Edison Thomas, who was an exhibitor who, you know, did incredibly well. He had several very, very large scale shows all running at the same time. And he was using local films and he was using the Boer War films. Local films went out of fashion, Boer War films went out of fashion all at once. And he ended up, you know, holding all this expensive assets, and people didn't want them. So he went out of business. And this was not typical, getting the quality back, because so many of these films from this era have been available in the past. You know, we've made copies and we've made, you know, we had 35 millimeter viewing copies, then we had, you know, early video and stuff. So you'd see a lot of these things used on the television, for example, in documentaries and stuff about early film. But the quality was terrible. But now we've got digital restoration technique. We were able to go right back to the original film elements and some cheap negatives and stuff and get really high quality images. And it's transformed, I think, the way we look at these early films. We did a restoration project on the WKL Dixon's 68mm films, for example, which are, you know, basically 70mm, if you can imagine that size. That's right. The size of the frame. And we scanned these at 8K, you know, frame by frame by frame. And the quality of the image is absolutely staggering. And we actually put them, we did a show called the Great Victorian Moving Picture Show, and we showed it on the IMAX. So they're that good.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, remarkable, but not surprising, I suppose, that formats aren't necessarily locked in stone at that point. Yeah, I remember when some of the cinema's first Nasty Women films were shown, there were a few very short British comedies from around 1900 that were all at like 30 frames per second or something like that. And you don't particularly know why, you know, why did anyone want a faster, you know, format like that, but it exists. So, you know, you preserve it.
So the Boer War films, for example, at WKL Dixon was taking on that format. They're staggering, you know, how much detail you can see, you know, because they've got full depth of field as well.
Sure.
So, you know, if you take a huge wide shot of, you know, the South African veldt, you can see all the way to the horizon. You know, it's really very amazing. And I think the problem is a lot of people have seen these very poor copies.
Sure.
And of course, film does deteriorate. And it's been difficult to tell what's going on. And the other thing is you can recognize people. So a lot of these early films actually contained images of the filmmakers themselves. So we were able to identify people like Dixon and R.W. Paul acting in their own films. So there's all sorts of things you can find out when you've got that level of quality. Just seeing expressions on people's faces really bring the films to life.
Right. I mean, we talk about you know, close-up was something to be invented later on, but when the film's in 68 millimeter, it's kind of all in close-up on some, you know, on some level. So.
And they smile as well.
Yeah, yeah.
They're smiling. So Victorians, we all think of British Victorians as this sort of rather stiff, miserable-looking people, or, you know, dressed in black and scowling, very serious. But of course, they're not like that at all. It's just that, you know, in those early Victorian photographs, you had to sit still for camera.
Sure.
And so smiling wasn't an option. So it's cheered the whole thing up.
The Story of Victorian Film by Bryony Dixon is available from the BFI. We'll also have a selection of a few of Dixon's favorite Victorian films, with some comments by Dixon, in the show post at nitrateville.com, so be sure to check that out. Part the Second, The Fatal Strip of Film. In 1893, Bertha Pruitt heard a witticism made by a young man at a dinner party. It threw Miss Pruitt into a violent fit of laughter that suddenly changed to a cry of pain as she fell to the floor, dead. From 1870 to 1920, the newspapers saw frequent stories about women killed by comedy. It was a warning about keeping women out of men's business, like jokes. But then came along the movies, and selling the possibility of comedy so funny it could kill you proved to be good business for the new medium. This very odd history is the subject of Death by Laughter, Female Hysteria and Early Cinema by Maggie Hennefeld, Professor of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota, who already took her life in her hands as one of the curators of the set Cinema's First Nasty Women. I spoke with her about this curious topic from Minneapolis. Well, first off, let me salute you for taking on the terrible health risks of watching comedy. As I'm well aware now of the extensive literature on how fatal comedy can be to women, so...
I actually once had a fellowship interview, and it was an all-male panel, and the chair of the committee referenced that at the beginning of the interview, and he said there had been a woman on the search committee, but someone told her a funny joke shortly before the interview was scheduled. I'm not kidding.
And she just dropped dead?
That was apparently she had like a cold or something, but it's also entirely possible that it was just an all-male committee, and they were addressing the elephant in the room.
Well, yeah, I thought it was interesting. I mean, this is a film book, but it's sort of not a film book until the third act, basically. Film shows up like Hickey and the Iceman Cometh or something at the end after everyone's been talking. So tell me what the premise or the point of this book is as a film book in which film doesn't figure till well into the process.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And to be fair, film does get three chapters in the entire third part of the book. It is a somewhat, you know, it's a long book. I spent 10 years of my life working on it. but maybe I could start with the origin story, which is that I was kind of finishing up research for my first book, Specters of Slapstick and Silent Film Comedians, which is about, you know, women in slapstick physical comedy in early cinema and late 19th and early 20th century cinema. And I really wanted to have a chapter in that book on women's laughter, women as laughing spectators in the vaudeville and the Nickelodeon, like in the kind of life world of early film culture. And I just started finding so much material, like there was no way it could be contained into a chapter. And while I can't remember what digitized database I was searching. I was doing all of these sort of mischievous keyword searches in like the World Newspaper Archive and Lantern and that kind of thing. And I found my first obituary, like woman goes to theater to watch a comedy, but ends up furnishing a tragedy because she laughs herself to death, right? Something super ridiculous like that. And I couldn't believe it. And I think I first emailed Jennifer Bean and Shelley Stamp just to like get their take. Like, what is this about? Have you ever heard of women dying from laughing too hard at the movies? And they're like, okay, you know, this is crazy. Take it with a bit of a grain of salt. You know, maybe they didn't really die. And then I just, you know, I guess sometimes we use the term of art is archive fever. And I just, I feel like I spent several years of my life doing keyword searches around different permutations of like death by laughter, like she laughed herself to death and so on and so forth. And I found over 100 of these obituaries, all from right around the time of the emergence and explosive popularity of cinema. So that's the origin story. But I mean, the book goes in so many different directions. I kind of start with a prehistory of hysterical laughter in the mid-19th century before that term implied enjoyment. In the mid-19th century, hysterical laughter was something that women suffered from in particular as a result of unresolvable mixed feelings. And it was basically the symptom of a nervous breakdown. So hysterical laughter was not enjoyable. It was not something you wanted to do. And all of a sudden, around the time that cinema is invented, and women in particular are being solicited to like laugh harder than ever, you know, break your corset stave in the throes of hysterical laughter at the cinema, and so on and so forth. Like while these things are happening, A, hysterical laughter is becoming funny or associated with having fun. And B, allegedly, like women are being terrified into believing that their excessive laughter could kill them at the same time that, you know, theater impresarios are like, hey, lady, you know, like come, like laugh your back teeth loose, like, right. You know, laugh your corset into disrepair, this like wild comedy about, I don't know, like a kitchen maid who breaks all the dishes or Leontine electrocuting the police department and so on and so forth. So that's the book. But yeah, I felt like I had to go through this sort of social history of women's laughter and then this whole midsection about laughter as a specific psychiatric symptom of female hysteria, you know, which was widely diagnosed in the late 19th century before I could get to cinema in order to just kind of frame the importance of what women's laughter, women's hysterical laughter in particular, meant in the context of film spectatorship at that time around the invention of the medium. So that's a very long, exhaustively wonky answer to your question.
Well, no, I think that's what is interesting about approaching it this way is you're establishing how the world worked before, you know, mass media came along and then how mass media changed it. And suddenly, you know, the word hysterical, which was fundamentally a medical term, starts being used to market movies, you know, to hype up how good they supposedly are. Which is just really interesting to me. I mean, it's like if schizophrenic or tubercular started being used to advertise things.
It is interesting, though. It's because it's both at once. It's like, you know, the movie industry, as it's becoming increasingly lucrative, and, you know, I mean, you know this history, like movie producers couldn't churn them out quickly enough for the audience demand, especially, you know, women, working class audiences, immigrants, like there was just such a hunger for cinema and for comedies, like these really lowbrow, insane slapstick comedies in particular. So I think this kind of hysterical rhetoric, like that, you know, this woman laughed so hard until the infant in her arms started crying, but she didn't care. She kept on laughing. Like that's a sign of, you know, the lengths that exhibitors would go to get women into the cinema, right? Like they would say anything it took to sell tickets, and what the audience wanted was comedy. But at the same time, as with all good things or any sort of like current of social change, the patriarchy or the old guard freak out. And there's, like just an eruption of mass moral panic. And I think that's sort of how I contextualize the Death by Laughter obituaries, as a sign of moral, an expression of moral panic about how much, just how much fun women were starting to have in, you know, the cinema in vaudeville, at the pleasure park, this like raucous new public sphere.
I mean, you classify these, you know, obituaries about Death by Laughter as running like 1870 to 1920. What do you think the shift was? Did the moral guardians just finally give up and say, oh, hell, let women go see comedy, or what happened?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, this is around 1920 is when I stopped finding these obituaries. Maybe they were no longer eye-popping enough to sell newspapers. But I mean, there are a couple of things. I think that actually you have to keep in mind the sort of anatomy of tight-laced corsetry. Women were still wearing corsets. Really up until World War I, when the corset started to go out of fashion. And I don't know, like I would probably die if I had to laugh while wearing one of those corsets. Like there could have been a physiological component related
to
corsetry.
Right, so you have an actual theory as to why this could be true. The corsets.
No, I hate it because I think it's false at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't know, like comedy became sort of tamer. There was less, I think women had less opportunity in like the really anarchic, outrageous genres of slapstick comedy in the 1920s. And the kinds of roles they played, you know, more of the ingenue, or the screwball than, you know, the Leontine by the 1920s. So I think the sort of gender sensibilities of comedy in cinema were changing around that time too. So that's part of my theory. I invite fan conspiracy theories as well.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. Comedy was a bit domesticated, and you know, it took the form of someone like Buster Keaton being kind of more a cerebral comedian than pure, you know, knockabout slapstick. So it doesn't seem like a terrible loss. But nevertheless, I mean, something about comedy does kind of change over that time period. I mean, I think also the audience just kind of went more middle class from working class before then.
Less knockabout slapstick.
The theme of this episode is going to be the Victorian era, and certainly we're getting away, you know, we're like mocking the Victorian era at some point in the 20s. There's just changes in how things were viewed, and I'm sure, you know, some guy with chin whiskers warning that comedy will kill young women, you know, just looks like a figure of fun at that point.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay, so part three, we get the movies to enter the picture, and let's talk about that process a little bit. How did the reception of comedy for women change once the movies came along?
They all of a sudden just had access to these sanctioned social spaces where their laughter was not only allowed, it was encouraged, right? I mean, we talked a little bit earlier about like what a commercial hook women's laughter was. It's frequently mentioned in the trade press, you know, for these split reel slapstick comedies, like, you know, The Leaky Glue Pot or At Last That Awful Tooth, are often described kind of metonymically as like 250 feet of nonstop laughter. But whenever laughter was gendered, it was always women's laughter, you know, come to the movies, women, so you can laugh. You can laugh louder and more convulsively than ever before. And there were all of these contests and gimmicks, like some theaters actually offered Death by Laughter insurance. I even found a plaque in just kind of searching through Lantern from the Media History Digital Library. This is from a little bit later in the early 20s, but a number of theaters offered Death by Laughter insurance for brave spectators who could make it through, you know, a full screening of Harold Lloyd's Safety Last without, you know, giving up the ghost from excess enjoyment. There were also, during World War I, exhibitors would offer like $10 to any spectators who could make it through a film comedy screening without laughing. So this Eastern European immigrant woman allegedly made it through two screenings of Chaplin's Shoulder Arms without laughing, but was stiffed on the first screening because the exhibitor wasn't in the theater to watch her not laughing. But then, according to her, she did get the $10 for the second viewing for not laughing during Shoulder Arms. So, you know, it was a gimmick, it was a contest, but this is what was drawing women to the theater. But also, I think cinema was really unique in this capacity, even more than the amusement park or the carnival or the traveling show. Like, this is where married women, this is where even respectable women could go to just like indulge in full throttle pleasure.
It's also just funny to me that you've proven that the idea of insuring the audience as a promotional gimmick way predates William Castle and horror movies in the 50s. So
That's a great reference. I wish I had mentioned that in a footnote, but yeah, it goes back to the very early days. One actually an example I opened the book with, which, you know, I feel the need to draw kind of contemporary parallels throughout, you know, in my like endless digital rag picking for material on Death by Laughter. I actually found a recent insurance advertisement marketed to comedians who like run the risk of killing so hard that it actually becomes literal, like that,
right.
like audience members suing them or family members of deceased audience members suing them, because their jokes are so funny that they actually kill. You know, so I found this ad. It's on the website of a corporation called Trusted Choice.
Right.
And, you know, there are all these tensions in the comedy industry today. Like, what, you know, is it safe to tell jokes? You know, are you going to offend someone? Will they sue you? Will you get canceled? But I find something actually utopian about, like, I don't know, comedians not worried about offending someone through, like, an off-color joke, but actually just like committing manslaughter through
right.
the laughter that their comedy provokes, right? Because it's about the laughter and not really the joke itself. And I called Trusted Choice. You know, I did some sleuthing. I'm a research academic. I can do my homework. So I called Trusted Choice, and they're really just a broker. They don't sell the insurance policies themselves. So I'm like, okay, I'm writing a book about death by laughter. I live in Minneapolis. And they put me in touch with all of these insurance brokers in the Twin Cities. And I called maybe like 10 firms, and none of them would give me a price quote on death by laughter insurance. And they're like, we have never heard of such a thing. We don't know anything about Trusted Choice. We don't know what this ad is. Like, you're wasting our time. And then, I don't know, I give a little bit more context in the introduction, but I just found it so weird and fascinating. So I think if nothing else, this is a book that is chock full of bizarre examples that like rapidly become too anecdotal or too autobiographical.
I thought it's really interesting that in the next chapter, you talk about how comedy went from being a cause of mental illness, of hysteria, to being basically a cure for it. People started using movie comedy to try and treat disturbed people.
Chapter 8 is about this use of motion pictures in early 20th century American mental asylums. And the idea of cinema, so wild, and hundreds of thousands of dollars were earmarked to install theaters and projection equipment in early 20th century asylums. And in all of the material I found about this notion of cinema itself as a visual cure to madness, because cinema was seen as a sort of universal language, it could be an all-encompassing cure to any sort of mental disability. At least that was the promise of the movie industry trade press. But slapstick comedies are mentioned as being particularly cathartic and therapeutic for people with suffering from hallucinations, epileptic seizures, melancholia, unspecified forms of delusional ruminations. Like, the idea was, show them slapstick comedies, you know, where a film called The Unlucky Trousers was mentioned, where a man keeps ripping his pants and having them mended only to like have something else go wrong with his pants. So films like that were like slapstick comedies about desperate people who, I don't know, like ultimately just give up, throw their hands up, were seen as being like, I don't know, really appealing to the kind of mental torture of neurodivergent spectators in early 20th century asylums. And obviously, the therapeutic value of early cinema in this context, probably, you know, much like the conspiracy of death by laughter itself, was somewhat hyperbolic. And, you know, broadly, you know, the language used in a lot of the materials I found is like very ethically dubious and offensive. but the disbelief in cinema is a cure to madness. And it's like the amount of resources that were, rallied toward that end is like super fascinating and not something I'd ever heard of. And so that's chapter 8. And the last chapter on cinema itself is about visual representations of female laughter in early cinema, particularly the briefly lived early film genre of the facial, right? Super short films of like a woman sneezing or laughing or yawning, you know, having some kind of spastic symptom into the camera, and then how those facials were displaced by slightly longer, lightly narrated films, which included emblematic shots at the end. So close-ups or medium close-ups that would have appeared at the beginning or end of the film, like everything from the bandit, you know, shooting the spectator at the end of the great train robbery to Leontine laughing hysterically after flooding her house in Leontine's boat. So sort of looking at what happened to those close-ups of women laughing hysterically directly into the camera, which were ubiquitous during the early silent era and then just sort of disappeared. Those visual depictions of women's hysterical laughter is sort of where the book leaves off.
Well, and talking about women watching and laughing at themselves, you promised me a story about the picture of Colleen Moore that's on the cover of your book. Tell me that.
So I just love that photo of her. She's in her home in Chicago in 1963, watching a television broadcast of the famous, you know, eye-rolling trick sequence from Ella Cinders, the Cinderella parody she started in 1926. And she's laughing hysterically, watching, you know, her own, it's a close-up of her face with her eyes rolling, you know, all over her head in impossible directions. While she's, you know, in her apartment, four decades later, in her house, laughing at this image. And I feel like it perfectly captures the duality of laughter as both, an escalation of madness, right? The laughing madwoman, and just an explosion of pleasure, which the book is all about. It's really all about that sort of duality and hysterical laughter between madness and pleasure. And I feel like this Colleen Moore photograph just nails it. And I don't really talk that much about Colleen Moore's films in this book. I do a little bit more in my first book, Spectres of Slapstick, but I'm a super fan of her, all of her performances, and had just been reading her autobiography, Silent Star, which I highly recommend. And this picture appears toward the end of her autobiography. And so, you know, I reached out to the publisher and they're like, oh, okay, we have to check about the rights and see if we can get an original of the image. And I was trying to figure out, like, you know, the publisher, the publishing house had gone out of business and was no longer accessible. So I reached out to Steve Massa because he has an encyclopedic knowledge of pretty much all of silent cinema, particularly the comedy genre. And he put me in touch with a Colleen Moore expert who you probably know, Joseph Uransky.
Sure.
And he was super generous. He talked to me on the phone, and he was the one who said he dated the photograph to 1963. The year isn't included in Moore's memoir. And he speculated that Colleen Moore's husband at the time, Homer P. Hargrave, had probably taken the photograph, and that Ella Cinders, the TV broadcast, it was probably either on The Toy That Grew Up or Fractured Flickers. And then he reached out on my behalf to Colleen Moore's daughter, Judy Hargrave Coleman, who very graciously granted permission to use the photograph. So that's the story of the book's cover, but I just am obsessed with that image. And as soon as I saw it, I would have gone to the ends of the earth to make sure that we could use it. There's one anecdote from Moore's Silent Star that I really want to share on your podcast, just because I've been trying to verify whether it's true, but it appears about halfway through the autobiography. Apparently, after the publication of Giovanni Papini's Life of Christ, when everyone in Hollywood was like scrambling to clear the rights in the early 1920s, Chaplin, this was a meeting that Moore said she had attended. It was toward the end of Chaplin's First National phase. And Chaplin had convened a meeting with the First National executives, campaigning, lobbying to play the role of Jesus Christ in the silent film adaptation of Life of Christ. And the quote in Moore's memoir, you know, Chaplin's kind of sales pitch is, "I am the logical choice to play Jesus. Like, just think about it. I look the part, I'm a Jew, and I'm a comedian. What more could you want?"
Right.
And yeah, obviously he's neither a Jew nor particularly looks like Jesus. I'm dying to know, because I haven't found that anecdote in any other source besides the Colleen Moore memoir.
Death by Laughter, Female Hysteria and Early Cinema, by Maggie Hennefeld, is out now from Columbia University Press. A link will be in the show post at nitrateville.com. Part the Third, Hiss the Villain.
But for plots, can you beat the old melodramas, where heroes were handsome, villains vile, and maidens modest? And who better to recall those spacious days than that great dramatic actor, Todd Slaughter?
Well, old man, you know they call you Mr. Massacre. Now's your chance to prove them right. So get into your clothes of the period and see Sweeney Todd outside his shop waiting to polish them off. Oh. Oh, what a nice little boy. Come here, Tobias. Come here. Now the first duty of a barber's boy is to keep a still tongue in his head. I knew a nice little barber's boy once who had his tongue cut out for letting it wag too much. Yes, and if you see or hear anything in this shop and breathe one word of it outside to a living soul, I'll not only cut out your tongue, I'll slit your throat from ear to ear. You have a beautiful young throat, Tobias. Oh, I should love to polish you off.
That was Todd Slaughter demonstrating the role he played 2,000 times on stage. Sweeney Todd, the murderous barber famously musicalized by Stephen Sondheim. But Broadway audiences of the 80s weren't the first to giggle with delight at the grisly antics of the demon barber whose shop was next door to a baker of meat pies. Back in the 20s and 30s, audiences took to the aptly named Slaughter's over-the-top revivals of old Victorian melodramas like Cats to Catnip. Powerhouse Indicator has put out a Blu-ray box set of the 8 quota quickies that Slaughter made in the late 30s. The Criminal Acts of Todd Slaughter. I spoke with Sam Dunn, co-director of Powerhouse Indicator, from London.
Now, the big question that I've had all along, does Powerhouse own Indicator, or does Indicator own Powerhouse? Why are there two names?
just to confuse people. So the company itself is called Powerhouse Films, and we decided quite early on that we would have a kind of an imprint, as it were, within the company, and we call that imprint Indicator. So we kind of internally refer to the Indicator series as being all of the films that we publish. And the idea was really that one day we might get around to doing a TV label or some other kind of sub-label, which actually in 8 years we haven't done. But that's the thinking. That's the thinking, at least, you know. Yeah, we like to mix it up. So, you know, you probably know we've done Mae West in Hollywood, Dietrich, all those kinds of things. But as you say, at the moment, we're sort of interspersing more classic Hollywood titles with some of the 70s French and now Australian genre films. So I guess it just speaks to our breadth of interest as a publisher as well. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get to Todd Slaughter. For people outside the UK who may have no idea who Todd Slaughter is, who's Todd Slaughter?
Oh, well, you know, you can find out. Go and buy the box set. Todd Slaughter is, first and foremost, he was a theatre performer, had his own troupe, didn't always take the, as it were, grisly leading parts, actually, when he was performing things like Sweeney Todd or Mariah Martin, which are a couple of the better known stories or plays that he acted in. He was often one of the other characters and didn't necessarily play the murderer, but actually he got a break to make films with a producer filmmaker called George King, and suddenly found a kind of new lease of fame or a new lease of professional life in the film, in the pictures, in movies, and went on to make, oh gosh, I don't, off the top of my head, I'm not sure, maybe 15 or so films, a number of which were made with George King, either as director or as producer. And they are all, and I mean this in the best possible sense, essentially the same story. There'll be a love rival, and he Todd in his leading role will, you know, be this kind of ne'er-do-well evildoer who's trying to get rid of his competition and win the hand of the girl through nefarious means. So they have this kind of slightly hammy aspect, which is fun, you know, and meant to be fun. And they're sort of well known in the UK, certainly at the time, for appealing to two different sort of sets of audience, a more working class, to use a sort of slightly British parlance, audience who enjoyed the thrills and the spills and the kind of the blood and thunderness, and a slightly better off class, if you will, a slightly more maybe intelligent or cultured class, might we say, who enjoyed the slightly wink wink, nudge nudge, sort of sort of cleverness, if you will, of the stories and the way that they kind of all sort of related to one another. So they sort of spoke to different audiences who came from different socioeconomic classes. So it's kind of interesting. I think for a long while, his films have been treated as pretty much second rate B pictures. Certainly they've been distributed in pretty bad quality editions. And I think that's because that prevailing wind of criticism, which was leveled at them at the time, that they, you know, they're just a bit schlocky and not much else, I think has persisted for a while. But I think, I hope what we've done with the box set is kind of put some context around the films and maybe tease out a little bit about who he was and what he was doing. And I guess you agree, since you're just saying you've been watching them all.
Yes. But
there's a lot to be admired and to kind of love and to get excited about them.
Yeah. Now it's interesting. I mean, he was a very much a workaday actor in the early years of the 20th century, but somewhere in the teens or 20s, there seemed to be kind of a change in how people viewed the Victorian era, or they just kind of like reconsidering the Victorian era. And, you know, some of that took the form of sort of camping up things that had been very serious in the Victorian era. I don't think he particularly plays them for camp, but there's something about the way that these old melodramas are performed, you know, with brio, certainly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's sort of obviously from a distance of, well, 90, almost 100 years, it's quite hard to understand how they did play at the time. But you're right. I think that there is something of that Victorian melodrama, definitely something of that Victorian melodrama. And we've done a book, and there is also another book that's out there on Todd Slaughter. And, you know, you can see the kind of plays that he and his troupe were routinely playing, and they're all of that ilk. They're that kind of blood and thunder entertainment thing was their stock in trade. So bringing that into the sort of bringing that kind of barnstorming thing into film was, I guess, it's hard to say at this remove whether it was new and daring and different, but it was certainly what he'd been doing. And I think the idea of putting that on film and seeing how that went down was really what was going on. And it just so happened that the audience was there and that they loved it. And, you know, he turned them out. He just kept turning them out over that period of, you know, 5 to 10 years from the mid 30s. So yeah, I think fascinating. Possibly in some ways he is one of, you know, possibly the original British horror star, you know. Depending on how you, you know, quantify these things.
Right. No, the other British-born horror stars were all in Hollywood by that point.
Exactly that, right.
Now, one thing I thought was interesting was the first few films all have kind of a setup that seems to be almost apologizing for making these, you know, tawdry melodramas. You know, in Maria Martin, we first get Slaughter and the other actors introduced on stage, you know, to remind us that this is coming out of a theatrical tradition. Sweeney Todd has this sort of comic wraparound story, you know, set in the present day, where Barber is telling a customer about Sweeney Todd and freaks him out, so he winds up running out into the street. And the most bizarre one is that, which film is it? Is it Stephen Hawke that begins with the radio program? It starts with Todd Slaughter on a radio program, but before we get to him, there's a couple of other guests. So for no reason relevant to the story, we get Flotsam and Jetsam, who were sort of Flanders and Swan-like musical comedy duo. All of it seems to be, to me, sort of apologizing for, you know, we're about to show you this, you know, this dreadful thing, but we want you to know it's all in good fun. It's, you know, it's serious in its day. I don't know. They seem to be kind of apologetic about them.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that's a fair comment. I don't know whether it's necessarily how I would see it. I think definitely, to kind of set context, they're sort of saying, as you know, as you've just remarked, that they come out of a very particular tradition, and that the sort of wraparound bookends are trying to convey that much, and maybe give it some relevance to the then modern day, that, you know, the kind of idea of the flashback or the story being told. The Flotsam and Jetsam thing is particularly strange, I think, fascinating as well as anything else. Yeah, and I think it's also about the personality of Todd Slaughter as well, because whilst these are stories and one is supposed to sort of get immersed in the stories and forget who the players are and be more interested in the characters, I think at some level the Todd Slaughterness of Todd Slaughter's performance is always there.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that this is just another device for kind of pushing that, really, for making him sort of, well, if you're... pardon the pun, center stage, you know, really, on the one hand, you've got a story being told, but it's very much a Todd Slaughter story. It's hard to know exactly what the rationale was or exactly how that went down at the time. But whilst I think an apology might be what's going on, I don't think that's the whole story. I think there's something else about kind of setting up the tone and sort of having a bit of fun, perhaps, as well.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. It's telling us, you know, it's not blood, it's red. Goddard phrase goes.
Depending.
In this case, it's black. It's like, don't take the gruesomeness too seriously. It's, you know, it's all in shuddery fun.
That's right.
Yeah, no, the one that I thought was really kind of revealing about what he was up to was It's Never Too Late to Mend, which is based on a serious novel that had real social effect on the idea of prison reform and things like that. But maybe by the 20s, people weren't really taking it seriously anymore, and so he's doing it on stage and sort of, you know, even though much of the film is you know, and I assume the play that it would have been associated with, you know, although, you know, some of it is quite moving stuff, it still has Slaughter, you know, doing it up in his big way.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's true. It's sort of having its cake and eating it a bit, isn't it?
Yeah.
As you say, the original, which was performed many times by different people and adapted a number of times, was, you know, sort of a rip from the headlines piece about the terrible condition of the prison system, and in fact apparently led to Queen Victoria instigating reform, which is obviously that's the sort of the social importance of it as a as an original text. But yeah, I think, you know, some 30 or 40 years later, Slaughter's doing something different with it. Well, because as you say, it is still quite moving. There's all that stuff with the young boy, which is profoundly upsetting, I think, and all the terrible tortures that are being meted out in the prison. But there's definitely still a kind of a glint in the eye and a a knowing smile and all of that stuff. So again, it's sort of taking another situation and overlaying it onto the blueprint of, you know, like we remarked earlier, that they're all kind of essentially doing the same thing. And so rather than being a barber or, you know, or a rich landowner, he's this guy who's in the prison system, in the reform, in the area of reform. And on the one hand, you know, trying to show himself as this kind of charitable doer of good things whilst, you know, doing terrible things.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, that's pretty much what he is in most of these. Sweeney Todd, yeah, who actually has a day job, is kind of an exception. But generally, he plays somewhat, you know, gentry, slightly elevated. So he's got the ability to sort of lord it over the people around him. But he's totally exploiting his position for whatever he's interested in, whether it's the buxom blonde servant girl in Crimes at the Dark House, or it's some fortune that he has his eye on, or whatever it is. He's a rotter. I mean,
he's a rotter. Yeah, and I love the fact that there's this kind of what would you say, kind of templated nature of the films, that it even comes down to having almost the same ending a few times, where he's, you know, he's got a bunch of people held up at gunpoint and he's just got the one bullet.
Right.
You know, that happens at least two or three of them. And in fact, some of the same lines of dialogue are spoken across a couple of them as well. So, and again, that speaks to a time when, unlike now, we can revisit these films and watch them over and over again and compare them side by side. These would come and go. Being kind of, I suppose, fairly cheap, I suppose, entertainment, and they would be, you know, akin to comics, obviously very collectible these days, but there would have been a time when we would have just read them and put them to one side, you know. So
right.
That's fascinating to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, let's talk about the production of these films. So these were quota quickies.
Yeah.
And tell me what you think a quota quickie is.
Oh my goodness, that's a good question. I mean, usually made by, I mean, in terms of British, I think of that being a very British phrase. So think about the Teddington films and some of the smaller studios that weren't necessarily, they didn't have the A-list actors and produced the A-grade entertainment. So, yeah, I think it was, you know, stuff that was done on a budget that was trying to create a decent yield so that it could effectively, the studio could keep going to make more and more and more of them. It's an area of filmmaking I'm particularly interested in, which is why that, you know, you see that we remarked earlier that we're doing the 70s French horrors, because it's not a dissimilar situation vis-a-vis budgets and doing all they can to please audiences who have very particular taste.
Right.
So very similar, I think.
Well, you know, and it's interesting. I mean, apparently, I got this from one of the supplement films. Apparently, one of the films was made so cheaply that it didn't qualify as a quota quickie. I guess you had to spend not too much money, but at least a little money.
Right. So there's something that's less than a quota quickie.
Right.
That's amazing. Fantastic.
I mean, you can spot a certain modesty in the filmmaking, the way the sets are used and reused and things like that. I mean, I thought they were quite decent looking. You know, they're all historical dramas except one. And so, you know, I don't know if they're like rented, sets or streets, you know, on the back lot or whatever it is. But I mean, you know, they're decent looking historical productions. Costumes are good, and you know, it's very much like what we would see later from Hammer, where they would, you know, they'd go borrow some country manor and shoot in it or whatever. So
no, I agree. I mean, I think one of the fabulous things that we were able to do, and this is part of the joy of doing what we do is go to the BFI, find out what their holdings are, discover that they have original nitrate negs for the majority of these films. And I think when you go there and you do, you know, you do the 4K scanning and then you get into the restoration space, the image, there's nowhere to hide in that image. So what you're seeing in the greatest clarity. So whereas, you know, you might have first seen a Todd Slaughter on an old DVD or even VHS or on some kind of late night screening, those old digibetas or 1 inches or U-matics or whatever they were that were made probably in the 80s, if not the late 70s, there's a lot of detail you're not seeing there. And I guess sure. At that point you can make all kinds of assumptions about what's going on, whether the sets are well-dressed, whether there's anything to be commended about the productions. But I think seeing them at this level, you're right. You know, there's a lot to be kind of admired about the production values, even on the budget. And that's really there to see now.
Quarter Quickies do not have the highest reputation for survival. I mean, I think they were not taken seriously, you know, for a long time by film preservationists and stuff like that. So it's kind of remarkable that these survive in such, you know, that nearly everything comes from camera negative. I mean, how'd that lucky thing come about?
Well, you know, I mean, this is a box set that we've wanted to do for quite a while. We managed to make the license a company we know and have worked with many over many years, and in fact I've known the main people there for a long time. When they said that they were working with the descendants of George King, we managed to license some of these, but then made further inquiries about some of the others that weren't on the, as it were, the availabilities list, and gradually we kind of unlocked more and more until we got the full, you know, King Slaughter collection together. So that was great. And I think after that, you know, you start finding out what's available and where it is, whether it's held by the estate or whether it's in an archive somewhere. And obviously the BFI was our first port of call. I actually used to work at the BFI for many years before starting Powerhouse. And they were all there. In fact, you'll have to forgive me for not quite remembering the order of play, but one of them, I think it might have been Sexton Blake or possibly something else. We did have access to the neg, but when we pulled the neg and scanned it, we found that it was actually through no fault of the BFIs, I should add, but quite damaged in terms of there being mold and so on and so forth on the image.
Right.
So we had to go to a pos element for that, to a print element, I think it was, or an internegative or something else anyway. Maybe it was a safety element. And although you kind of lose a generation in terms of film printing, what you obviously gain was clarity, you know, in terms of there not being any of that mottling effect and damage to the picture. So I think in all cases, we got really the very, very best available element. And that is thanks to, you know, the archive, the BFI in this case. And, you know, them being British productions, that's where you would expect to find them. But as you say, it's not always the case. There are many, many films missing. And then you've got a different problem entirely. But yeah, it was amazing to get those, and for them all to be nitrate was quite special as well.
Yeah. What else did King do? Are there other treasures in the, you know?
There are. Yeah. I hesitate to say too much because before too long we'll be making an announcement about some more King films. But yeah, we do. I've revealed that much. We do have some more of his. I mean, you know, to your point and what we've been discussing about these kind of lesser known films, whether anyone's first position is to think of them as classics or not is another matter. But I think when you get to revisit or even see these films for the first time, given that they were made in the 30s and 40s and so on, I think you find that there's a lot to be admired, a lot to be gained from watching them. They often have key players who went on to do bigger and sort of better well-known things. I just find that fascinating, the sort of exploring the highways and byways of certainly British film. That's my particular thing, but, you know, any film, really.
Sure.
So, yeah, we have more. I think it's difficult to make a case for him being an incredibly important producer, I guess, and filmmaker. But nonetheless, you know, as we've already been remarking, there's a quality, there's a consistency, there's definitely an ambition. And I think that comes across in all of the films, The Slaughters and some of the others that we'll be doing.
You know, and it's interesting. You definitely get that. You know, some of the later supplements on the disc are like like the quiz show film and things like that. I mean, they show these are from the 50s, and Slaughter's career is basically over just about at this point. I don't know, he died somewhere in there. But, you know, they definitely show that there was an affection for him, and he was well remembered by people who were old enough to have seen these things when they came out. So, you know, there is a certain admiration for, those were so fun, you know, his sort of attitude.
Yeah, as you say, the sort of strange quiz one, the Puzzle Corner number 14 thing, is from the mid-50s, which, you know, is some 20 years after the fact, or certainly in terms of the Sweeney Todd character is 20 years later. And, you know, as we've been saying, you know, these films, I suppose they might have run in cinemas, but ostensibly they came and they went, right?
Right.
But the idea that he lived on in popular imagination is fascinating.
And he was still touring for a lot of that time.
Yeah.
Although I get the impression that once the war came, maybe that was, you know, sort of the tail end of his fame, that doing, you know, why do Victorian melodramas when you've got Nazis to be villains and things like that?
Exactly. And you've got noir, and you've got all of that stuff. You've got a far more kind of gritty, brutal cinema emerging. Definitely a huge change of pace and taste, I would have thought. But yeah, you're right. You know, it is fascinating to see those later short films on the set and to kind of think, oh, okay, Slaughter still means something.
Right.
Very interesting.
Now, what do you think his legacy was? There's a point in one of the supplements where they're talking about, I guess it's in one of the essays in the booklet. There's a booklet with this, folks. you know, he's talking about who sort of picked up from Slaughter's overripe style, mentioned James Mason in some of those early Gainsborough films like Fanny by Gaslight. I don't know, you know, Hammer in some ways is the obvious connection. And there actually is a connection in that Slaughter made a Burke and Hare film later, and the same writer of that basically recycled it for Hammer. So
that's right.
I don't know, who else do you think is sort of Slaughter's heir in British cinema?
Oh, goodness me, that is a great question. Very hard one to answer. I mean, I think, you know, any era and any sort of particular area of film always has descendants. You know, I think without Slaughter, you don't have Hammer. Without Hammer, you don't have something like Pete Walker and some of the other kind of 70s British horror filmmakers like Norman J. Warren and so on and so forth. So I think each thing is a development from the last, you know. So I'm sure that Todd Slaughter's cinema must have kind of tendrils and connections to a lot of British, I think, genre cinema particularly, and anything that goes for slightly unsubtle, slightly OTT action and melodrama, definitely has, you know, I mean, there'll just have been legions of people growing up watching that stuff and taking away whatever they felt were the best bits or the most important facets, I think. So, sorry, it's a bit of a generalized response, but I think he did have an effect, and I think it is right to point to some of those connections with Hammer, and also to some of those performances like from people like James Mason. I'm sure that they must be direct connections.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, the quotes in the booklet show certainly people, you know, supposedly in higher end cinema, I mean, they were all well aware of Slaughter. Graham Greene reviews him very favorably.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, someone, I think maybe Green, says you can see where Charles Laughton got a lot of his stuff. And that's the person I think of, you know, in his time as coming closest to playing, you know, Slaughter like characters. You know, the other one that I thought of, I mean, he's not a horror star at all, but as a comedian, I think Terry Thomas, you know, gets a lot, not least the extravagant mustaches from Slaughter, but just that business of being a professional rotter on screen, you know, he seems to carry on.
I think that's a good call. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
So Slaughter's career, he continued doing stage, and he makes some other films later on. So he never quite goes away. What do you know about his later career?
I know mostly the films in this set, I have to say. And in fact, before we started working on the set, I'd really honed in on the obvious ones. So it was a great opportunity to see some of the ones that to me were slightly lesser known. I mean, we'd love to do more Slaughter because the response to this set has been so great, you know, and from all kinds of quarters. You know, the fact that someone like David Tibet from Current 93 was such a fan was really came out of left field for me. And we, you know, he got very involved with the release and actually gave us quite a lot of material to use because he's a huge collector, has all kinds of letters and photographs and paraphernalia.
But he did the music for a couple of the supplements.
Which, you know, it's just really great to have people like that involved because I think they help get audiences from all different quarters. Because I think, you know, you can come to this set because you're a fan of British horror or because you're a fan of kind of early British film. But I think to come from a kind of more sort of left field experimental end and sort of find some joy and pleasure in this is pretty interesting as well. So we love getting people like David involved. And in fact, everyone that contributed was just, they weren't just people who knew about Todd Slaughter. They were people who were desperate to be involved because they'd been obsessing about him for decades. You know, Kim Newman was like, if you ever do Todd Slaughter, you've got to get me involved, and you know, and so on and so forth. So that was really exciting, really great.
A link for The Criminal Acts of Todd Slaughter, 8 Blood and Thunder Entertainments, from Powerhouse Indicator, will be in the show post at nitrateville.com. Felicitations to my guests, Bryony Dixon, Maggie Hennefeld, and Sam Dunn. Music is by Kevin MacLeod. Be sure to subscribe at the podcast application of your choice and leave us a rating and a review at Apple Podcasts. Your humble and obedient servant, Nitrateville Radio.
I think this is a very unpleasant episode brought to a very satisfactory conclusion.